This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or send in your question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good, good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. All right. We've got a couple of questions today, and we're just going to fly right through them as best as we can. Dear Dr. Lyle, why wouldn't a man want to spend the money to keep his home up when he's able to afford it? My husband likes to spend his money on expensive luxuries like sports cars and exotic trips, but he doesn't want to update our home in ways that are long overdue. This is an ongoing source of frustration for me and friction between us. Please help me understand why and what I can do about this.
Okay. All right. Well, let's back up. And once again, we're going to look at the fact that all behavior is a result of cost-benefit analysis. And so we also know that expensive luxuries are fitness indicators for people to display. So a male that's displaying a fitness indicator, peacock's feather fitness indicators like out there, is advertising for mates. And so the fact that this guy's married and that he is advertising for mates, particularly it would look like he's advertising for outside mates outside of the relationship. He's not advertising to the female within the relationship. Otherwise, he would be absolutely responsive to fixing up the house that they're in that she wants fixed up and he doesn't want to spend the money on. So that's what you're looking at here, is you're looking at evidence for that the priority there is to signal to outside other females for casual mating strategy. So what can you do about this? Well, there would be a number of things to do about it, but the first thing to do is to understand it clearly and then to sort of put your foot down and make sure that, this is a bit of a complicated clinical issue, and I don't want to give a snappy, what was that lady's name? Dr. Laura answer. I don't want to give a Dr. Laura answer to a problem that's actually more complicated than this, and there's going to be personalities and circumstances involved here that are going to be subtle that would determine how it is that I would manage this clinically. But certainly the fundamental issue here that's the root of this problem is that the wife is feeling like she is not that highly valued, and the husband is signaling that. And what the husband needs to know is that he is signaling that, and that the signal is being heard loud and clear, and that such a signal is very risky to that relationship, and it's essentially cancerous. So that the problem needs to be solved at the level of that signaling. So if this is what the husband is actually feeling and wanting and what he wants to signal, then that's one thing. If he's actually sort of asleep at the switch and is inaccurately or essentially mistakenly making his investments the way that he is making them, then he needs to be educated that this is deeply insulting and these are in fact defection cues that he is sending by these decisions. And so he needs to be educated along these lines so that he can correct the situation if it's something that he would be motivated to correct.
So my question is, I guess, from the other perspective, is the female trying to make the house display fancy so that she can display for other mates, or is this a way to get, you know, the village, you know, to get village support for her children and her genes?
Yeah, she's right. She's not really displaying for mates. She's looking to display general gene quality for general problems. It could be displaying to the village that her children come of high gene quality. It doesn't hurt for her to display to other potential mates that she was able to secure resources, you know, a great many resources, et cetera, and so that to both males and females she is signaling this. So somebody thought very, very highly of me. Okay, is sort of what that signal is, and so that certainly adds to her cachet. But in general, a female is not doing this in order to secure casual mating, because males are not really interested in being provisioned by females, and so that isn't really what she's about. She's displaying and proudly that she it's essentially also a signal that she is extremely important to her mate. And it can also be a signal to the village that she has won this mate and that it's essentially exclusive, okay, that all the fancy resources are coming here. That's where they are. So that's kind of some of the things that are transpiring there. So, yeah, it's definitely what the male is up to is clear, and what the female is up to with the beautiful home strategy is not the same thing. It is actually a different put it this way. Let's put the shoe on the other foot for just a second. So if people want to see this a little bit clearly, you can do an internal role reversal. Imagine a situation where the female has no interest in decorating the home at all. Okay? Doesn't want to put a picture up of her and her mate in the home. Basically never decorate it, even though the husband wants her to. This was a scene in the novel The Fountainhead, where Peter Keating was married to Dominique, and Dominique is his the beautiful haywire female Rand heroine of that book. She is not interested in essentially really being his wife. You know, she's got a twisted up Randian psychology, and so but it's signaled through that very process, and so that is a big-time rejecting program of the female towards the male. If the female is adorning her nest and wanting and accepting the resources from the male and showing off those resources, that is not her showing off to other mates. It's showing off to the whole village that she's got this mate secure. She's a very high value to that mate, and look at how fancy our stuff is. Therefore, we have good genes. It's a much more general sales job.
Okay. All right. Well, next question. Dear Dr.
Yes.
Lyle,
oh,
I'm
wait
50 years old. Oh,
also,
yep.
Hold on. I want to also spin the role reversal on the other side. Suppose a male is investing tremendously in the home being nice and really doesn't give a damn about his car, and he's driving around in a Dodge, you know, caravan with little stickers of the little, you know, stick figures of him and his wife and his four children there. What is that signaling? That is signaling Parabon psychology all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is once again, we're seeing that as we play our way through these role reversals, the question that this woman is asking is very clear. She is reading the cues right, and it's disturbing her a great deal. As she says, this is a source of ongoing friction, and this is the reason why.
Wow.
Okay.
All right. Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm 50 years old. My husband of 10 years wanted to be a swinger and asked me to give it a try. We've done it for several years now, and I feel just about ready to quit. It was never really my thing, but he loves it and doesn't want to stop. How do we resolve this?
Huh. Well, in general, my way of looking at conflicts of interest of this nature is that people should never be essentially pushed into doing things that they don't want to do. And so that, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me that that would be a legitimate way to do anything. Relationships should be, in principle, aiming at what we're going to call the intersection between two personalities. So let's suppose that, you know, we've all met people in this lifetime that were somehow naturally very, very connected to each other, practically breathed the same air, and had practically the same thoughts, and would never want to be apart. So Paul McCartney and his wife, first wife, Linda, apparently didn't spend any nights not together for 25 years that they were together or some such thing. You know, that was the love of this guy's life. And the there are people that are extremely intertwined in that way, and good for them. They've found somebody that fits that well. There are other people that can have good relationships that are very much worthwhile, but the amount of overlap into who those two people are might be considerably less. So you might think of this as Venn diagrams, where two people are overlapped 90% and another two people are overlapped 35%. That might be two people that have a love relationship, but it's just not at the same level of interpersonal closeness and intensity. It's its own thing. It's like a different dining experience, okay? Just a different kind of a restaurant. Now, however, what we don't want to do is take two people who would be, say, normally 50% overlaps, and then essentially say, well, we're going to make it 70. Okay, we're going to force it. Because if we do, that means that somebody is doing some major conceding. And in this case, we're talking about doing things that are making one party uncomfortable, that is really not what it is that they want to do. I want to, we could use different examples here that would highlight this in a way that might be useful. Let's suppose one partner likes to smoke pot, but the other one doesn't. Can you imagine a situation where the partner that's smoking says, no, I want you to smoke. I'm going to be uncomfortable if you don't. It's like, wow, that's a little odd. Okay. Similarly, if the person who does not want to smoke might say to the person that is smoking, listen, I don't like to be around you when you're high. That's totally legitimate. Okay, it's not the same human being when they're high as when they're not high. Okay, so it's like the person that's liking to get high might say, well, gee, you know, it's just part of who I am. It's like, yeah, well, it's not the part of you that I want to be intersected with. So I'm fine interacting with you when you're not under the influence. But when you're under the influence, I don't like it. That's a legitimate set of boundaries as to the degree of intersection between those two people. So this situation is, there's a reason why women are choosy and with their sexuality, and that's because the eggs are the most valuable thing on earth, human eggs. In other words, female sexuality is, you know, is what you see all the tall buildings in the world and all the fancy crap and Rolls Royces and Jaguars and, you know, what do you think that's about? Okay, this is a competition for getting resources, partly in response to the competition that males need to go through in order to compete for resources to compete for females. So the notion that some female is going to be talked into outside of her marital relationship to be doing something, giving that away, or having experiences that she doesn't want to have, she's designed to guard the eggs. That's how she's built. And women are going to be quite different in their proclivities about when those defenses come down and when they do and when they don't come down. But they're usually pretty defensive. And usually, even in situations where they may be very open to experience, they're still very choosy. And so the swinging lifestyle is a lifestyle that is fraught with conflicts of interest between husband and wife, and the notion of one person, you know, wanting to push another person into it is going to be problematic. So my attitude is that you, once again, personalities, individual differences, individual sets of circumstances, etc. But in general, the notion would be we're not doing something on any level where one person doesn't want to do it. If they do it, they might be interested in doing it once a year, twice a year, once every 5 years, or once in a lifetime. But if they don't want to be doing this often, then it is absurd and out of line for one person to be pushing another person. It doesn't make any sense, and it's cancerous. All right, let's go on.
All right. Dear Dr. Lyle, what's up with Valentine's Day? And, of course, this is 1 week after the male Valentine's Day, which is March 14th, and one week after male Valentine's Day and 1 month after, I guess, normal Valentine's Day. So, dear Dr. Lyle, what's up with Valentine's Day? Why do guys always feel guilty about having to, quote, deliver the goods, like flowers, jewelry, dinner on this day to their beloved, and their beloved expects the goods to be delivered? Is there some evolutionary psychology basis for this? I sure hope not.
Let me think about this. Let's just think about this. I've never given this any thought. It makes sense to me. You know, people develop at times when there are sort of cultural signals of or times when we're going to be giving. So Christmas, for example, this is a time when we display by what it is that we give how much we care about other people. That's what it is. And so this is a so that makes sense. It's a signal that we're sending to how valuable the other person is. And we also have one that's highly individualized, i.e., just birthdays, things like that. Anniversaries, etc. So Valentine's Day is one such signal, and you know, I don't know who put this together as a marketing scheme, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it's with us, and so therefore, it becomes a signal. And so, so of course, there's pressure on males because they're competing in principle with other males who are everybody's essentially, this is a signal of provisioning of male to female is what it is. And so you're going to be normally in a situation, as you could expect, that the very nature of wealth is that it's limited and that there's not enough of it. What animals are trying to do is they're attempting to gain resources, including humans, and you're trying to make really careful decisions about the expenditure of those resources. Our fellow with the house that needed work, but with the Ferrari or whatever it was, in the driveway, is sort of, you know, trying to figure out the best use of where to put his resources relative to his interest in casual mating strategy versus his wife. In this case of Valentine's Day, the guy is thinking through the expenditure on this day for this mate relative to all the other things on his agenda, including getting new brakes for her car, you know what I mean, getting paying for her school tuition or paying for his own, you know, he needs a gold tooth, whatever the deal is. He's got a lot of time and energy problems in his life, and now he gets to compete with the expectations that female has about a set of resources coming her way. So no wonder this is stressful. If a guy happens to have a lot of resources and feel like he's over-rewarded, this is a really exciting time for him to land a bunch of resources on her and say, listen, you know, I may be getting over-rewarded here genetically, but look what I can do for you. In other words, in that case, that guy's not feeling guilty or anything else. He's, you know, looking forward to Valentine's Day being a day when he might be able to just cement her in a little bit. And it could be also just a relationship where it's all very healthy and good, and he has sufficient resources and not a problematic conflicts of interest with resource allocation issues, that it's all grand, and he enjoys the entire process. However, in a great many cases, the guy's already getting access to the female sexuality. The relationship is whatever it is, and the truth is that this is a night that's going to, you know, that's supposed to nail him for another $500 or $600, but he's going to try to get out of it with $300. So this is the stressful situation that it is. All right.
All right. Dear Dr. Lyle, why is it that a woman can tell a man she's not happy for, can tell a man that she's not happy for years, and then when she finally leaves him, he's stunned and says he thought everything was fine? I've seen this dynamic play out again and again. Why do men think everything is fine when their wives are clearly signaling that it's not?
You know, I'm not, I mean, this is a person who's reporting something that, that, you know, it's an interesting observation from the standpoint of reporting the dynamics of that particular couple that in theory that this person is talking about. But the truth is that I don't believe there's any scientific evidence at all that indicates that this is one directional, that this is a process that the female goes through versus a process that the male goes through. So it's just, you know, I think that if you're a female that goes through this process, it's much more salient to you. And so you're like, look, I raised the issue, i.e. I bitched and moaned and bitched and moaned and bitched and moaned for 10 years, and I made it as clear as I possibly could. And then when I leave you, you're surprised. Like, what the heck? Why weren't you listening? But the same thing happens the other direction. Men may not be interesting. They may not be as verbal, but they send the signals nevertheless. Okay? So the signals are being sent, and I don't think that anybody is tone deaf. I think that people don't believe necessarily the threats, and usually those threats are usually the noises that people make. If they're not squawking loud and threatening loudly, then most of the time people are, you know, people are running the CB on the other side. So in this notion, in this hypothetical case, the guy doesn't really believe that she has that she's got a better option than the one she's in. And so he's looking at the situation, and he's basically thinking to himself, I think it's fine. I don't think I have to invest any more in this relationship. I'll just do exactly what I'm doing now, and I'm in an equilibrium. Okay? In other words, I'm getting what I'm getting, and this is what I'm paying, and that's good enough. And so when the female squawks that it's not a good enough deal, it's like, well, how many times did she squawk? 117 times in 107, you know, in 1,000 weeks? No problem. Like that meant that 116 times I was right. There wasn't any big threat at the end of it. So the fact that someone may eventually become upset and eventually follow through on a threat that's been leveled for years, and then somebody's surprised on the other end, of course they would be surprised, because it hadn't, most of the time it doesn't happen when you see this dynamic. So anyway, that's what I'm saying. So I don't, The underlying commentary or question that's being made here is, why are the men tone deaf? And my answer is, they're no more tone deaf than the women. I'll be brutal here, okay? This isn't exactly a PC podcast, so let's just point something out. I have heard this, like, oh, if he mentions my weight, that's grounds for divorce. The truth of the matter is that men may make an awful lot of noises about women's weight very quietly, okay, sometimes not so quietly. And what's going on inside those men's heads that they are expressing is that they're frustrated with the women's weight. Now, I'm not blaming women. There's 50, you know, integrated reasons why this is a fight. You know, I wrote a book about it. But the point is that are we going to say that women are so surprised? You know, women are so shocked when the guy actually leaves after 15 years of bitching about this in his own way. Hey, I see this commonly. And what I will often see is right before he goes, as he makes his final signals that he really means business, suddenly she starts dropping 10 or 15 pounds. It's like, really? How come you weren't listening the last 15 years? Now, I know it's difficult, but this is the mirror image of this question, and I'm just pointing this out because we're seeing that within marriage relationships, and this is the broader answer to the question, within marriage relationships, what's going to happen is that the whole cultural societal evolution of marriage makes a very high barrier to exit romantic relationships, artificially high barrier to exit, all behind the defense of wealth and being directed towards offspring's, you know, the genetics. We've discussed this at other times on the podcast. So because marriage puts a artificially high barrier to exit behind financial implications that were never there in the Stone Age of this magnitude, as a result of that, people relax. Essentially, you don't have competitors. You've basically signed an agreement that's given you a monopoly over that person's existence, and as a result, everybody gets comfortable, okay? So when people get comfortable, that doesn't mean they're happy. When your partner starts getting comfortable and essentially starts putting out less benefit relative to the costs that they bring, you may not be happy about it, and this is what I call the chiseling chip. In other words, if I can get those same goods for X price, I think I can get it for X price minus 1%. And the partner on the receiving end of that who just got chiseled says, I just got 99% of what I was getting before. You know what? I'm going to give 98% back because I'll probably still get the 98. And through this process, it's very similar to the process of what used to take place with hard money coins, that you would see a gold coin and you have a bunch of chips. You know, somebody take a little chunk out of it, out of the edge of a gold coin. It's still worth, you know, $20, but it's 20 because it's stamped $20 on it, but a little of the gold is missing. Okay? This is what I call the chiseling chip. And so within marital relationships, you will see the chiseling chip, and then people will start, some people will start squawking about it, and some people may squawk consistently, but a lot of times the partner basically feels like, hey, I'm not going to do anything about this because I've got a big barrier to exit and you've got a big barrier to exit. We're not going anywhere. And so this is what they think. And then, of course, on the rare occasions when somebody walks, the other party can be very surprised because they thought essentially they were protected by this financial societal expectation matrix. And they weren't. Sometimes you're not.
Wow.
All right.
Dr. Lowe, we got time for one more?
Got time for one more.
Okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, why does it feel so devastating when your spouse cheats on you, even if it's just a casual hookup or a one-night stand? My husband cheated on me 6 months ago, and I can't seem to get over it. How do we move past this?
Well, I think the reason why that's going to stick with you is because there's a threat there. In other words, we could say this two ways. We could say this like, oh, well, he cheated on me 6 months ago. It's just sort of one time. It's like, okay, well, now hold everything. Let's think about this. He just cheated on you one time. Let's think of the circumstances under which this took place. This guy had to think about it, had to plan it, you know, had to go to effort, probably was on the market for, you know, some period of time flirting with a number of possible prospects that he took seriously until one actually all matched up and everything, you know, all the little gears clicked relative to the other female psychology, what it is that she seemed to be wanting out of the relationship, what any financial implications were, what the expectations were, blah, blah. In other words, wait a second. How many prospects did he have to look at, and how many prospects did he have to get, you know, 90% of the way through the door before he finally got one that he got all the way through the door? It would be naive to think that this was a one-time thing that meant nothing and just sort of happened to fall into his lap and, oh, well, not bloody likely. Okay? So if it's 6 months ago, your brain is now, and this got found out, and who knows how. But the point is that female mind has to be on red alert, essentially thinking, what are we looking at here? Okay, so not sure what to make of it. This is clearly should be read as a significant threat. Now, we don't know what it all means, and we don't know that that this isn't ultimately a solid enough pair bond that it's worth continuing on, et cetera, et cetera. And there's individual differences in females about this that are huge. In other words, this is just natural differences in female psychology about this. I knew a woman that got cheated on once, and 25 years later, she was still ruminating about it daily and giving the guy the third degree constantly, 25 years later. Okay, this guy really stepped in it. Like, if you're gonna do it with this girl, you should have just left. I mean, this poor guy. I mean,
psychological BDSM.
That's. I mean to tell you, okay. Now, there's, on the other hand, there's other people who are, you know, much more forgiving and have, you know, short memories and et cetera, et cetera. So the individual differences are huge. It isn't for anybody to say what is the right way to view this thing. The wrong way to view it, however, would be to view it as nothing that shouldn't be thought about and shouldn't be ruminated about. Of course it should be. And so it isn't a matter that you have some modern-day ridiculous, you know, Victorian view of human sexuality and that you shouldn't be upset about this. No, you should be concerned about it because that it is a significant possibility, that it is a signal that you are, you know, that you could be in some trouble, if not this year, then next year. And so as a woman in a marriage, you know, the marriage is these days is not about the romance and sex and excitement and protection and some provisioning that took place in the Stone Age. Marriages today have houses, mortgages, children, et cetera. They have there's much greater implications for your life than there would have been 10,000 years ago. And as a result, the tentacles that a mate that looks like they may be straying, you know, these have deeper reaches, and therefore they would be cause for anxiety anyway, but they're cause for legitimately greater anxiety today in some respects than ever before.
Not Dr. Lyle, thank you.
That's pushing it. Then in our natural history. Yeah, if cool. You're in 1940 cool. In Appalachia, that's a bigger problem.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.